The following is a production of DifferentBrains.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spectrumly Speaking. I'm Becca Lori, your house autistic and also a life coach. I'm joined here by
Dr. Lauren Gerber. I'm a clinical psychologist and author of Autism and You.
Good morning, Lauren. How are you doing today?
Doing well, Becca. How was your weekend?
It was pretty good. It was busy. I had some family events on top of some autism acceptance stuff. So I've been kind of on the run for the last couple of days. And yours?
It was busy as well. I'm glad to hear from you, though. I'm looking forward to talking today.
Me too. I'm looking forward to our guest. We have the fabulous Anita Lesko with us today. I have the pleasure of having her as a friend and also seeing her speak publicly a whole bunch. Anita is also an autism advocate like myself, and she was diagnosed with autism at age 50. She's a graduate of Columbia University in 1988, where she earned her master's in nurse anesthesia and has been working full-time for 28 years as a certified registered nurse anesthesiologist. Her special interests have included her flight in a F-15 fighter jet and jumping horses over six-foot fences. An internationally recognized autism advocate and member of Autism Society of America's panel of autistic advisors, Anita is married to her husband, who is also autistic. She has a new book coming out in September by Future Horizons that's going to change healthcare for autistic individuals around the world. Anita is also a project co-lead on a $250,000 PCORI-funded grant for adults with autism and other stakeholders engaging together. This project aims to improve healthcare for autistic adults. I'm looking forward to talking about that later in our conversation. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Really happy to have you. We're going to just start our interview, which is with the one question that everybody always asks me, and I'm sure they always ask you too, which is, how were you diagnosed?
Well, I went the first 50 years not knowing that I'm on the autism spectrum. I always knew I was different. I never fit in anywhere and had all kind of various sensory issues and social interaction issues that I thought I was like the only person on the face of the earth who had all of this, because I had never come across anyone else who had any of these rather seemingly bizarre things. One night at work, a coworker, she came into, I was getting ready to eat dinner. She came in the lounge. She's like crying and saying, "Oh my God, my son has just got diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome." I looked at her and I said, What is Asperger's syndrome? I had never even heard of the word. And she hands me some papers. In the top paper said, if you have 10 out of these 12 symptoms, you have Asperger's. Well, as I read down the list, I had 12 out of 12. And I looked at her, because she had known me for about 10 years at that point. And I said, "Lisa, oh my God, I have Asperger's." So she looked at me and she goes, "Oh my God, yes, you do." Because I guess it suddenly hit her that I had all the same things as her son had, all the same issues and everything. So that night I stopped at the bookstore. I picked up every book about Asperger's, read everything that I possibly could. By the morning, I knew without a doubt that I had Asperger's. Well, I then went and got formally diagnosed by a neuropsychologist a few weeks later, just to have it formally diagnosed. So then I can give the letter that I got from the psychologist to my employer. And it was that moment, though, when I read that list about the if you have 10 out of 12, when I read all of that and suddenly realized, oh my gosh, all of these things my whole life, it's something that other people have. And like all the pieces of the puzzle of my whole life kind of suddenly fell into place and made a whole picture. It was certainly what you call, I know Oprah Winfrey calls it the aha moment. Mm-hmm. Well, that was certainly my biggest aha moment, because that night totally changed my life forever after I had gotten diagnosed.
Absolutely. I had a very similar experience. It was a big, huge wave of relief. Suddenly everything that had made no sense to me in my entire life made sense in that one moment. I had a very similar experience. And I also was diagnosed late in life like you were. So we're finding, I think, in the community that many women get diagnosed late in life, either because they've had a child that gets diagnosed or they have a friend whose child got diagnosed. And I'm just curious how you feel about late in life diagnosis. Did you think it was worth it? And do you think it's kind of more common for women than it is for men?
Well, it was certainly worth it. I mean, because my whole life was a puzzle, and especially I had always felt sorry for my mother because she always thought she did something wrong to make me so different that, like I was. But what actually happened once I realized that I'm on the spectrum, then we're kind of looking at each other and realized my mother also had Asperger's as well. So all throughout my life, she never thought any of my behavior was unusual because it was just the same as hers. For women, I don't know. I know now there's so many adults being diagnosed that are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. From everything that I'm reading, just like you said, sometimes the child gets diagnosed and then the parent realizes they have it, or they happen to see something on TV or hear something on a radio, and all of a sudden it makes sense to them, and then they realize they have it. And women, I know, in my own particular case, because I work in an environment where I'm the only person on the spectrum in the ocean of neurotypicals, as I call it, I never tried to pretend I was something that I'm not. I just always just felt to be myself, which in many cases that didn't necessarily work out in a very positive manner because of the fact that I never tried to pretend or be something I'm not. Now, I know I'm familiar with the fact that a lot of people do try and pretend to be normal. I never did that. I always was, just referred to and thought of as the oddball at work. Whether they thought of me as eccentric, weird, crazy, whatever, but I never tried to be something that I'm not, mainly just because I didn't know any better. I'm just me.
Well, that's pretty amazing. One of my favorite things, though, that I love to share with people and I love so much is your story with Abraham, your husband, and your wedding, because for me, knowing that you were able to find that peace and that love at that point in your life, it gives me hope that I can find the same. And I think it gives hope to a lot of people. So would you mind just talking a little bit about your relationship with Abraham and how you guys decided on your wedding to go that way?
Well, okay. Well, I met Abraham. I used to run an autism support group meeting once a month. I did that for actually quite a number of years. And one very stormy, rainy Saturday, in walks this man with his mother. And they had heard about me from a college professor at the University of West Florida, which is nearby here. And that was when he walked in the door, little did I know that that was going to be my future husband. There was something about him, aside from the fact that he's a great-looking guy, but aside from that, there was something that drew me to him as the meeting went on. I just felt a sense of comfort or peace from him. Mm-hmm. And that just really struck me, and that was actually the thing that kind of drew me towards him. Mm-hmm. We became friends. We were friends for over a year before the relationship turned to a romantic one. Then after we had gotten engaged, just prior to that, I had gotten invited to speak out in San Diego at a conference called the Love and Autism Conference. And after I got engaged, I called the conference organizer, and I said, what would you think if we got married at your conference as part of the conference? And I told her I just got engaged and all that, and she, without bat of an eye, she was like, wow, yes, well, this would be great. And I said, I want to open a wedding to the public for numerous reasons. One, I want to get the word out to the world that autistic people actually do want love and relationships and marriage, and also to give other autistic people the opportunity to attend a wedding. I had never gotten invited to a wedding in my whole entire life. Mm. So my own wedding was actually my first wedding that I ever attended. So from there, kind of one thing led to another. Then actually the conference organizer and myself kind of simultaneously thought of the idea of having the whole entire I Do crew as being all autistic. Mm-hmm. So we then from there started organizing. I had asked my dear friend, Dr. Stephen Shore, I asked him if he would be the officiant of the wedding and actually perform the wedding ceremony, which he jumped at that opportunity. Mm. And then we, assembled all these other autistic folks, a harpist, the best man, everybody was autistic. And the conference organizer had started doing some press releases of this. Well, the next thing I know, we've got we were in People twice. They put a video clip of our wedding day, of our wedding and everything, on Good Morning America. And it was kind of reaching all around the world, to England, Australia, and everywhere. And we were very thrilled that this word was getting out. That was our goal, and to bring people, the public, into this whole thing to see this. So we were very happy that that all transpired.
It was absolutely beautiful. And I must tell you, it was very touching to watch. And I think we need to talk maybe a little bit about relationships for people on the spectrum and what that is. But what interests me is that a wedding itself is a social construct, and that this entire social event was put on by and for autistic people. And that, to me, shows the desire that people on the spectrum do have to socialize. And while we're more comfortable with each other than we are, I would say, with neurotypicals, we do have a desire for socializing, and it's really a learned experience. So for you, this was your first wedding, and it was yours, and it must have been huge social decisions and a lot of detailed decisions that you were making about something close to you. Is that more difficult, do you think, because you're on the spectrum, or less so?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny, because the conference organizer actually planned the whole entire wedding. We really had not, I mean, she would ask my opinion about different things or who might be getting involved in it. But basically, she did all the planning, from everything to the cake to music to everything. So we basically all had to do was show up and walk down the aisle. So
perfect. It sounds ideal to me, I have to tell you.
I'm sure every bride on their wedding day gets overwhelmed when they're going to walk down the aisle. But for me, when we had gotten this harpist, she was autistic, and she started playing the harp for the wedding thing when the bride walks down the aisle. And I froze for a moment, and I looked at, there was about 250 people in the audience. And it just hit me that, oh my gosh, a couple of years ago, before I even got diagnosed, I didn't even have one friend. Now I'm getting married. There's all these people here. I was so overwhelmed. It was a very surreal experience, I would describe it as, because I just really couldn't believe that it was actually happening to me. Now, I will share this. My whole entire life, when I would see all in the stores, like brides magazines and all that thing, I would just quickly kind of turn my head the other way, because I always felt, oh my God, I can't even keep a friend or find a friend. Certainly I'm never going to get married. And it just would break my heart to see that everybody else, mm-hmm. that's happening too, but not me. So I would quickly just turn away from those kind of magazines before I had gotten diagnosed, and just thought, I'm this really weird person from another planet. Mm-hmm. The realization that a wedding is never going to happen for me.
Yeah.
So that diagnosis really changed my whole entire life.
What's interesting, thank you so much for sharing both your story of your diagnosis and your marriage and wedding, because it's so nice to hear when somebody gets diagnosed late, like you did in your 50s, the impact it has on life and every aspect of it. There are things that maybe you think of that are before diagnosis, and things that are after diagnosis. And I wonder if you separate things by time in this manner, or how you look at it. I think the fact that your wedding was so public, and that you had 250 people there, and this was well out of your comfort zone, just demonstrates your strength of being and all these different positive aspects to you. So I'm so glad that you're sharing this with us.
Well, yes, when you say that, the before and after, the big before was total isolation from the world, really. I mean, yes, I went to my job, I did my job, interacted with people all day long, but they're not my friends, and it's just it's a job, and I do what I have to do. And I was certainly able to interact with, in the operating room, you have to deal with surgeons and nursing staff and scrub techs and patients and families and all this thing every day. And I was able to do that very well. But then I would leave, the minute I walk out the door of the hospital, it went back to the extreme total isolation. The only friend I had was my mom. She died in 2013. But other than her, I had nobody to talk to, just total isolation. So then after the diagnosis, then all of a sudden I have a social life and friends and going places and meeting other people just like me. So it's one extreme to another.
I'm very excited to talk about the next topic. It's something I'm really excited that you're tackling and happy to be a part of it. Wanted to talk a little bit about medical advocacy. Now we're getting into the nitty gritty of Autism Acceptance Month, where it's kind of talking about the issues that are still lacking support and lacking kind of being addressed in our community. And as the number of adults grow in the spectrum, the number of us diagnosed adults grow, and as those that were diagnosed as children become adults, one of the things that we're finding is our struggle with emergency responders and with the medical arena and how we're going to deal with what essentially becomes a co-occurring diagnosis. So it's whatever you're at the hospital for on top of your autism. So I'm just curious if where you want to start. Do you want to talk about what you wrote first, and then we can talk about the conference coming up?
Sure. A while back, you know, I realized one day, I thought, well, I'm autistic, but I'm also a medical professional for 28 years. What a combination to use that to help others on the autism spectrum, because I myself, I'm guilty, and I'll be the first one to admit it, I avoid going to doctors. I avoid any kind of anything and tend to treat things myself or take care of whatever by myself or figure out how to fix it because I don't want to go to doctor's offices. Now, here's somebody who's autistic, but I'm also in the medical profession, and I'm saying that. So multiply that by all the other people on the spectrum who don't want to go to the doctor's office for various reasons. It's massive sensory overload. You know, the minute you walk in, just even to start with making an appointment, you have to call on a phone. Most of the time you're put on hold. And all the things have going along with making an appointment. It would be helpful if they made appointments that you can do online. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to deal with anybody to make a basic appointment. Once a person arrives at a doctor's office or an emergency room, you're there in the area with lots of people, always bright lights. Typically, there's multiple TVs going, every possible thing that's a massive sensory overload on top of the fact that you're either sick, something's broken, injured, or something. So start combining all that together, and it's going to become very rapidly a situation of a person having a major meltdown. I wrote a book that's coming out in September from Future Horizons, and the title of the book is called The Complete Guide to Autism for Healthcare Professionals and Ancillary Staff. And I'm hoping that this is going to be instituted not only across America but worldwide to help educate healthcare providers and first responders. They all need to understand what autism is, but further, they need to understand how to communicate with us. All different options of communicating, whether it be verbal, written, texting. You know, don't look at what kind of facial expressions we're making or not making. I included all of this in the book with the hopes, and I've actually went out and went through a whole scenario of a person getting admitted or coming to a hospital and going through all the way through discharge, what staff would need to be able to do to enable us to have a positive healthcare experience. We're going to end up with a lot of unhealthy people if there isn't a major change in the healthcare system, and I'm hoping that I'm going to make that change happen.
I really hope so. I mean, I know one of the challenges for me, I consider myself that I live openly autistic. I talk about it all the time. I live my life kind of dumped out for public view. And I find, though, that when I go to the doctor and I kind of sit down, and one of the things I always say when I'm meeting a new doctor or a new professional or I'm in a new medical scenario is, you know, I have autism, so please understand I may be more sensitive to medication, so you need to watch your dosing. And, you know, I may not be looking at you, or I may have my sunglasses on because the fluorescent lights are terrible, but I understand. I come with lists a lot of questions, of things I'm concerned about, which can be really weird to a doctor that you would even ask them or question them about anything. Many people don't. So it's kind of a new kind of advocacy to learn, that medical advocacy for yourself, to question what's going on with yourself. So I'm excited to see your take on it and get it out there. And I just want to talk to you a little bit about the conference that you managed to get this huge grant for, which is going to be the start of this conversation, I think, for many people.
Yes, with this PCORI grant that we got, so the first conference that we're having is in July, and it's the day right before the Autism Society of America's big conference. So we're assembling a group of 20 people. It has to be either autistic adults or parents of autistic adult children. But we're leaning more, I think it'll end up being possibly two, maybe three parents of adult autistic children. The rest will be all autistic adults. And this is forming what we're calling the community council. Now, at the conference, the individuals that will be guests at the conference, we're actually going to assemble them into, break it down into groups, that in each group, a community council member will be the leader of that group to formulate within that group what people think are the most important priorities that they see as needing for themselves to get positive health care. Then once we have all of these lists and suggestions, and we're going to compile them together and then use that to base our next phase of the research on, and then actually instituting those our findings in the healthcare setting to enable autistic adults to get the healthcare that they need and deserve, just like everybody else.
Yeah, and it's really amazing thing to say, here are a group of people who are highly invested in the community, either as individuals or as the parents of individuals, saying, this is what we need from our mouths to you. This is what we require. And I think it's a great chance and a super platform that we're going to be standing on. And I'm entirely grateful to you and Dr. Stephen Shore and Teal for having put together this conference. I'm excited to see what it comes of. I think we have time for one more question, so I'm just going to ask the one that I've been kind of saving. I had the grand pleasure of seeing you at the UN speak. It must have been a humongous honor to be asked. And you did talk about relationships along with the other conversations that were happening at the UN. You want to talk a little bit about that experience?
It was a very overwhelming experience. It was overwhelming the day I saw the invitation, and even more so walking into that building and then watching all the other people that were speaking during the conference, great autism leaders of the world all brought together to that one place to make a difference, was extremely overwhelming. I was very pleased with having the opportunity to have my voice heard. Hopefully it'll reach far and wide. After that session in the morning, there was a special lunch that I had gotten invited to, and I wasn't really sure what that was all about until I got there and what it was. All these world leaders to do with autism and employment. Mm. And at one point I was so overwhelmed, and they were taking questions from the audience towards the end. And I put my hand up, and they had me get up, and I got up and I said, thank you to, I said, as an autistic person, to be in this room with all of you who are here working towards helping autistic individuals gain employment. It was so overwhelming to me, absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah. It's so nice to hear that those conversations are happening, the employment, the medical, the real deal transportation conversations. I mean, these are the things that impact our daily life, and I'm proud to know that, you know, our voices are being heard out there. And you were fantastic at the UN, so I will say, you definitely made me cry. So it was great.
And it's an honor to have you speak with us here, because the advocacy for autism is such a necessary activity, and especially this month during Autism Awareness Month. Your Complete Guide for Autism for Healthcare book that's coming out, I cannot wait to read it. And where would people be able to find out more information about you and this book if they wanted to?
It's being released in September, and I suspect around probably July and August, Future Horizons is going to start publicizing it and all of that kind of thing.
And where can people find you if they're looking to find you, Anita?
The best place to look right now is, it's called my new organization I started, called Global Autism Consulting Organization. If you look at it, to shorten all of that, I put it's global ACO.org, shortened for Global Autism Consulting Organization.org.
Well, it's time in our show now to talk about some current things going on in the news. And Anita is going to stay with us so that she can weigh in with us on some of the topics. One of the articles that I saw is about Florida officers being required to have more autism awareness training if a bill that's going to the Senate right now passes. And we've had a few incidents here in Florida where individuals have been afraid and interacting with the police, and officers haven't really known what to do. So they're now going to require, if this bill goes through, autism awareness training of all officers. And it sounds a little bit like needing the training and the complete guide for healthcare providers. So I thought it might be interesting to have you weigh in on the thoughts on that bill.
Yes, that certainly is needed. Well, I've actually had experience where one time I was home alone and my security system went off in the middle of the night. And when I dialed 911, and I was pretty jacked up, scared. And I'm sure I was talking very, hyper and in a panic. And the woman, the dispatch woman, started yelling at me, "Ma'am, just settle down, just settle down. There's no reason to act like that." And she's going on and on yelling at me. And the more she yelled at me, the more upset I got. So her yelling at me did not help in any way. Of course, that was before I knew I'm autistic. Because had I known then, I would have said, "Ma'am, I'm autistic. This is how I act when I get in a panic."
Mm-hmm.
And I know other people on the spectrum, it's very easy to get into a panic or just act very unusual, that first responders wouldn't know what to do with us or think we're a person could be on drugs or weird or do whatever, not taking into consideration, they're autistic, maybe take them over to a quiet place away from flashing lights and all the chaos, So, yes, that's a definite thing that is definitely needed.
Yeah, absolutely.
As this bill is making its way through the Senate, it would require officers to train and recognize the signs and symptoms of a person with autism and how to respond to them. And there was a case that really tipped this whole thing off here, where a therapist was shot in Miami after his patient wasn't listening to commands from a police officer to lie down, and they were together. So the therapist was with the adult with autism, and the shooting occurred, and it really became clear and obvious that in these situations, police officers need more knowledge and they need awareness, very much like you were speaking about the healthcare profession. So it's major professions that interact to safeguard and help with the health and well-being need to understand all individuals, not just the ones, as you said, that are in the ocean of neurotypicals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think the conversation in regard to emergency responses needs to continue. I've heard a bunch of ideas within the community over the last few years, carrying a card on you that you have autism if you become nonverbal in emergency situation. Of course, all of the little coping mechanisms or the little tips and tricks you could do to make it easier for yourself kind of have to be recognized by the other side. And without them acknowledging that you're going to take a card out of your wallet and it's not something else, it sort of takes away the ability of that card to do you any service. So I think it's a really interesting component of all of this, because of course the same kind of panic can happen when you're calling 911 for an ambulance if you get to that point. And of course, then there's the panic and anxiety that come with physically not feeling well and not knowing what's going on. So
right.
I think that it is very similar, Lauren. Absolutely. It's a very same conversation. The need for it strings from the same place. Just that if you want autistics to be out there in the world, then we're going to be. And if we're out there, we need, you need to know you're probably going to run into us. I mean, if you run into 69 people, you've, by statistics, run into somebody who's autistic in that way. So I do. I love this story. And I like that we're talking about these things. My news article, not as controversial, but still very close to my heart. And it's all about being told that you don't look autistic. For me, that might be my biggest trigger of all time. And it definitely drives me crazy. First of all, because autism doesn't necessarily look like anything. You can't see it. It's an invisible disability. And also because we're all so varied on the spectrum, I'm not sure what people expect to see when they say you don't look like it. And then what does it look like is always my question. So I spend a good chunk of April, I would say, defending my autismness, I always say. I'm always defending my autismness because my autism struggles are very much internally based. So all of my neurological and physical, you know, challenges don't show themselves on the outside. Nobody sees it. And certainly if I'm in a social situation, I'm working really hard to fake it until I make it. If I'm not comfortable with everyone in the room, if it's a place I've never been, it certainly triggers all of my social anxiety. And that's sort of, and then someone approaches you and you're open about your autism and they say, well, you don't look autistic. And I think sometimes they mean it as a compliment. I'm not sure, but it's always kind of shocking every time it's said. It's like, well, I don't know. I've been walking around this way for a long time, but you have to admit, you know, at a certain point, they might have something to say because I lived 36 years not being diagnosed. So I like the conversation about it, but I don't like how it makes me feel. I don't know if you have this happen, Anita, but I have it happen all the time.
Yes, I have that occasionally from patients. I'll actually go and say to, I'll ask patients and their family in the pre-op area after I do my official, you know, assessment of them for the anesthetic and the surgery. Then I'll, if I have time, I'll say, so do you know anyone who's autistic? And sometimes some people say, oh, yes, you know, I have some family member, this or that. And then they'll often say, no, I don't. But why do you ask that? And then I'll go and I'll say it because I'm autistic. And then they kind of look at me. Some people get, oh wow, that's really great. You don't look autistic, right? There you mm-hmm. go. Some people kind of look all of a sudden scared, like, oh, my God, an autistic person is going to be doing my anesthesia. And I see that look, too.
Mm-hmm.
One time at the YAI conference in Manhattan a couple years ago, some woman in the audience, she goes, well, you know, she goes, I'm really enjoying what you have to say, but you don't seem like you're autistic at all. And I said, well, I said 20 years ago, you would have seen it very readily then because I get better as I get older for sure. Mm-hmm. I said, but if you spent any time with me, you will very easily see all my little autistic ways and everything and how I react to different things.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, well, it's internal things like I flew to Manhattan and back home within 3 days, you know, flew there Thursday, did the presentation on Friday, flew home Saturday morning. Well, I'm not the happiest flyer in the world. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of anxiety. You wouldn't know it by looking at me, but inside my body feels like it's having a massive breakdown.
Yep.
But yes, so much internal stuff that, and no, on the outside, there is no thing that has a big stamp on you that says I'm autistic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was really appreciative to see someone else was talking about it this month and had posted it online. There's another blogger from the UK, which always for me gets interesting, right? Because the language in the UK about or surrounding autism is slightly different. Just like they say toilet differently, they say other things about autism right. differently. So you have to kind of skew a little bit when you're reading to know that they mean a different word in English or in American English, I should say. And so I was really interested that many of this woman's perspectives were very similar to mine, regardless of the fact that we were not from the same country. So it seems to be a pretty prevalent thing to me. And while many people are kind of get, I also get that I'm jealous that you can pass conversation. And for me, that always is like, oh, so you're telling me I don't look autistic. That's how I hear it because I'm still so sensitive about it. But, you know, they mean it as a compliment. And I think, oh, that's awful. Do you know how much work it is to go out there in the world and even just to go to the bank and just to try to keep it together enough to quote unquote pass and get in and out without a long conversation? That stuff, you know, it's like, oh, but I wish I didn't have to do those things. I wish I didn't have to expend so much energy just trying to do things in a quote unquote neurotypical way so that my life was easier, because even though it's harder, it's short term easier to get in and out of a situation. So I'd love to see along those lines that just that conversation. There is no, this is what autism looks like.
Exactly. The media thing also, though, has a lot to do with, you know, they portray on some shows sometimes, you know, that people, everybody thinks, oh, that's what autistic people do.
Yep, that stereotype behavior. It can be very damaging, and it continues the stigma that we see. So working really hard to say, no, I don't look like what you think autistic looks like, but I can tell you what it feels like. And that's sort of where I come from. Anita, I thank you very much for your time. Can you just let everybody know again where they can find you?
Sure. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being on the show. People can find me at globalautismconsultingorganization.org. They also can find me at simply anitalesko.com and on Facebook as Anita Lesko.
Thank you so much for your time and your sharing and your vulnerability. I really appreciate it very much. I'm so happy to share all of your thoughts and ideas here with everyone. So thank you for coming, Anita.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It was an honor to have you here. Thank you, Anita.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up for us today here at Spectrumly Speaking. For more, be sure to check out differentbrains.com and check out their Twitter at diffbrains. Also, you can find them on Facebook. If you're looking for me, you can find me at beccalaurie.com, or you can look for me on Facebook and LinkedIn.
And I can be found at drlaurengerber.com and also on Facebook and LinkedIn. And please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Don't hesitate to send us any questions or comments. We'll bring them up on our future shows. Let's keep our conversation going.
Spectrumly Speaking is a production of Different Brains. For more information, visit us at differentbrains.com.